Welcome to the Playbook. I'm David Meltzer. I'm here at the greatest stadium ever built with the biggest waiting room in the history of all waiting rooms. That's 66,000 people, $5.5 billion and growing as far as the expenses go. And there's no better house to host somebody like Jeremy Wong. He's a global entrepreneur, tech consultant, CEO of JW Private Wealth. Welcome to the Playbook.
Thank you very much.
All right, I'm going to start with the obvious. Everybody's in the wealth management game. There's false gurus, 19-year-old wealth coaches, which is really a courageous human being. I don't care how wealthy you are at 19, I'm not using you as a coach. I've been there.
Maybe what not to do, right?
Yeah. And in the realm of the marketing of wealth advisors, wealth coaches, wealth managers, financial service people, they all throw the same bullshit at you. And no offense. Yeah. Look, you know, too many people have been taken advantage of. How about all those athletes out there? The 75, look, I ran the fucking agency. I went bankrupt myself. And it's not because of the wealth advisors anymore. 75% of athletes go bankrupt because they make an extraordinary amount of money at a young age and they don't have the capability of asking the right people for the right questions. It's not that there's these dishonest wealth advisors. Look, if you're not a fiduciary, most of the wealth advisors out there are salespeople. They're salespeople. They're selling products that they know nothing about. I was on the phone with one of my brokers yesterday. I brought millions of dollars of IULs asking questions because I'm working directly with a fiduciary to understand exactly how an IUL works. He couldn't answer a question if his life depended on it. So I see in your profession such a disparity between the intention of most wealth advisors and the actual practice of wealth advisory.
Yep.
I know which side of the fence you're falling on, which is why I wanted you on the podcast.
Thank you.
And so could you explain what you learned at a young age that has led you to do things differently than just be a salesperson?
Yeah, I think, you know, going back, how I started was I started training as a gymnast when I was 7 years old. So a lot of my discipline, where I came up, you know, my habits, I had a coach that said, every time you say can't, you do 100 push-ups at 7 years old. Okay, so
like
you can imagine the negativity quickly goes out the door. And I had this vision, you know, I'm going to go to the Olympics. All my friends went to the Olympics. That was my only thing I wanted to do from a very young age. Injured myself 13 years after. Herniated disc, back, everything. And
What event did you hurt yourself in?
Parallel bars.
Nice.
Slipped off, cranked my shoulders on the uprights.
Sorry I asked.
And, you know, it was painful. And I thought I could recover. But this nerve stuff, you know, every so often you go to tie your shoe and then immediately you're out, right? And I don't know how long it takes to get back. So it was really then I realized, okay, I depended on my body as an athlete. I trusted it for many years. I knew I could rely on it. And then this rug pull came out and I figured I need to be able to get into things where I can either build a company or I can invest in others, where they can keep doing what I need to do, even if I'm injured or sidelined and whatnot. And it was through those experiences that I built a lot of my initial habits of how to treat people, how to make sure that you're honest with different things, right? And how to leverage different experiences, even though they may be failures. There are investments that will always inevitably go bad. But what do you do to leverage that and recover from it and then build onto the next step as if it was even better than it initially was intended to be? So that.
And what I hear you saying is something that's super interesting and relevant to me, which is the faith part of sports and business, meaning that you spent 13 years in a divine direction towards where you thought you want to be or better. Gold medal.
Yep.
Right? And I know a ton of people like that, right? Been blessed to represent and assist them in those pursuits. The Sean Merritt's here often, 17 medals,
yep.
5 gold medals in the 400, world champion. But it's interesting because it is a death. when you can't do your sport anymore. Whether you were a high school, college, professional athlete, it doesn't matter. When it ends, it's a death. And so most athletes or people who have passion in a business, if you have that type of desire that you must be what you can be as a gymnast, a football player, a business person, when you can't do it anymore, it's a death.
Yeah.
And that's where this idea of these push-ups meant so much to me, that God had already planted seeds that the word can't means you're punished.
Yeah.
And the word can means you're protected, promoted, loved, and perfected. When there's no evidence, or in this case for you, the evidence was completely contrary to where you wanted to be or better. Looking back now, where you are today in the wealth management side of what you are, in the expertise of empowering and helping people create legacies, financial legacies, especially for them and their families, do you feel protected, promoted, loved, and perfected when you had your injury?
Yes, I would say yes.
At that time, did you feel
that
way?
At that time, I didn't feel like it. At the time,
I wouldn't have either. When I lost everything, I didn't feel that way.
At today, the time, yeah. I would say at the time, 100%. It's especially because that was the first time that it happened.
Yeah.
You know,
how old were you? 20?
I was 18.
18.
So 18 when that happened, and your whole life direction, you know, changed. I was gonna go to the Olympics. I wanted to be a sports medicine doctor. That was my direction back then, and your world just kind of crumbles. You're a little bit lost and whatnot. Now looking back, because I've gone through a few of those iterations, I feel super protected because I know that we essentially get to write where our journey goes. You know, the end is only the end if you decide that the game is over, and I've just decided the game's going to keep going indefinitely. And the piece that really filled my coffers that I didn't know I had was about a year after that, in university, I got recruited to college cheerleading. And now looking back, it was kind of a lateral step, right? It was a lot of the experiences that I had, but it was just a minuscule piece. But I was quickly able to leverage that and become the top of my craft, right? I became one of the best in that space. And over the course of the next 15 years, I won 5 world championships. 4 as an athlete, 1 as a coach of the team, and I built a conglomerate of 7 companies, and we operated across 24 countries. So I then was no longer a gymnast. I was no longer a sports medicine doctor. That identity quickly went away, but I took the learnings from those and turned it into what I had then, right? Which was building those companies, doing that passion, and it allowed me to travel all over. So it was a completely new journey that I never could have saw when that first injury happened.
And I like that story because it's one in which I try to help other people with. It's not a transition. It's an expansion of your skills, your knowledge, and your desire. And there's no doubt in that story that you took the skills, knowledge, and desire that you had and expanded it into what was doing well, what's stable, what you thought was going to be doing well in the future. And it created an exponentiality, an outcome that was successful,
right,
in your perception of your divine direction, even though it was completely divergent from the direction you started in, like being a doctor and also, of course, a gold medalist. So
right.
In the realm of that, let's put it back into your double stack leverage philosophy. Understanding how life happens.
Yep.
How does that, or how is it relative to the double stack leverage? Because time, emotion, and value changes immediately when we make a decision, when we come to an agreement. And it seems to me, from my understanding of it, that like any other good methodology or program, it needs to take into account that time, emotion, and value are going to change.
Yes.
And so how do we incorporate this mindset that you've had, this strategy that you've learned, into the double stack leverage philosophy that you've come up with?
Yeah. So kind of in the wealth advisory practice, we're always looking at how to maximize or optimize your holdings, but also to protect your assets, right? And, you know, what better asset to use than something that's been around for 5,000 years, right? Anyone know what that is? Gold, right? So gold's the one that we use as a...
Which is way up today, by the way.
Way up, all-time highs, every day, right? Yeah, exactly.
Thank God.
So, yeah, exactly. So,
especially for COVID.
That's right. Yeah, yeah, exactly. So we started using this technique. You use it as an asset-backed strategy, but we created a system, and I coined it DSL, and you leverage the holdings that you have, and you can optimize what you're getting on a return by like up to 40 or 50%, because you can leverage your holdings, borrow against it, you know, up to like 60%, get the appreciation, and deploy that either in purchasing more of that asset or putting into something that just returns.
And just so we help everyone, that is a long-lived successful system from Rockefeller on of asset-based lending, whether it be insurance-based, houses,
yep,
true secured assets, gold. This is how, especially that you can actually feel excited because tax rates in California are 52%. You're excited about that when you're borrowing money at 1% against a secured asset and the secured asset is averaging a 9% gain, you're hedging 8% on your money and being able to utilize the liquidity of the money.
Correct.
Is that a fair way?
You nailed it. Okay. Nailed it. Yeah, exactly. So it's the, you essentially mirror the strategies of the ultra wealthy, but it's accessible now with technology and whatnot. The system that we've designed, you can purchase this from your phone. It's going to be stored in a vault that you have access to offshore, protected jurisdiction, and then you can sell it at any time. And you can leverage that loan all from your phone. I mean, this can be done in the matter of hours, right? Whereas in the previous, something like this might be weeks and weeks. Different advisors, you got to put it to a bank, you got to do it. So it's
Swift accounts.
Swift, yeah, it can get very, yeah.
Homeland Security. IRS. The bank holding your money just for an extra couple of days. So on average, they can get the percentage.
Exactly, right?
I love that. One time I got a cashier's check and they're like, there's a hold on it. I said, doesn't that defeat the purpose? I go, so if you Bank of America get, let's just say $100 million of cashier's checks a day worldwide, and you hold it for an extra day, that's a lot of money. And me, consumer idiots, like, no problem, one extra day.
Yeah, that's fine. You got to go through compliance to check that the money that you've already checked to make the cashier's check.
Yeah, the money I took from your account to buy a cashier's check is good. Interesting. Anyways, I digress.
Yeah. So, no, I mean, that's the DSL system. So we're...
And to that end, why don't... And I know there's some people here that I've partnered with in this side of it because... To me, if somebody would have taught me this the first time around,
right,
I'm not sure I would have listened in all fairness, but if at least I would have been aware of it and they planted the seed, the amount of money I would have today would be ridiculous. It would have been literally mathematically impossible for me to go bankrupt.
Yes.
It would have been compared to the stupid shit I was doing. Regardless of the Ferraris, the cut, everything I owned, it would have been mathematically impossible. To that end, why don't we teach this in the junior high schools, colleges, and why aren't people taking advantage of it from the time they start making money?
I think one of the key things is the education system isn't caught up to the speed that we move in business today, right? There's technologies that change. There's different just instruments that you can use. And because the mass media and, you know, the general public doesn't have access to these strategies. They're high wealth strategies. They sound unbelievable, or they sound like out of reach, or, you know, foo-foo.
Here's an interesting philosophy I have. There's bad actors and bad practices. And because of the information and the dissemination of information, it's very easy to confuse bad practice with bad actors.
Yeah.
And we do it a lot, whether it's lawyers, judges, doctors, insurance salespeople, solar sales, whoever it is, there's bad practices and then there's bad actors. There's good practices with bad actors, though.
Also, yes.
And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that people have in the financial services industry is that if you practice any of the products that they have, right? Premium products, the IUL products, annuities. Yeah. If you have a good actor with that product and it's aligned with your timing and risk tolerance, it's a really good opportunity.
Yep.
The problem is that we publicize the bad actors and they confuse it with the bad practice.
Correct.
And that's your biggest challenge as a business person, do you think?
It's one of the biggest ones. You know, when you we've used these strategies for a long time, but not mass, because a lot of people just don't, they can't uptake it, right? They're like, ah, I'm not ready for it, or I've never heard of this. None of my friends use it. Well, if your friends are the ultra wealthy, you've certainly heard of it, right? So, you know, everybody in this space, the minute I mentioned DSL, you know, the first thing Dave, you know, he could rack off all these different asset-based lending, because when you're in that space, there's no way you wouldn't leverage those types of strategies. So really what I want to do is I want to educate a lot of, open it up to more people to be able to take up that. You can start in smaller amounts. Yeah. You don't need $1 million or 2 million, right? 10,000, 20,000, that's enough to start it. And going back to what Dave said, that compound, if you had started young, mathematically speaking, you'll outrun all of your expenses, because that compound is unbeatable.
So the philosophy that things happen slowly, then all of a sudden, is a perfect philosophy for finance, right? That's why all my kids, when they're born, I started.
Yep.
Right, I just started, because think about what it means to get four extra or five extra or six extra doubling effects. Think what that means monetarily. So if you start someone at the time they're born, every 7 years, it's going to double on average. So by their 21, you've guaranteed them three extra doubles. Most people don't invest at the earliest till 28. Most people invest 35 or 42 or 49. By starting your kid when they're born, seven extra doubles. So let's just say it was $2, 2, 4, 8, 16, 32, 64, $128. That's just the start. $2. Now, from $2. So what does that do to 20,000?
Now it starts getting interesting.
It gets really interesting. And so the problem with the human psyche in understanding, for me, is this 1,000 steps. Right? There's 1,000 steps to get to where you want to be or better. None of the steps are equal. You have to take two steps back to go three steps forward. It doesn't matter if the steps are bigger or smaller, slippery, dirty, broken, or you fall. The key is that most human beings quit before they get to 250 steps. Of the 1,000 steps they know it's going to take to get to where they want to be or better, regardless of what it is. Why is that? Because it takes 90% of the time, emotion, value, energy, effort. It takes 90% of everything you got to get to 250 steps. See, it's only another 5% or so to get to 500 steps, and only another 5% to get to 1,000 steps. And then it's only, believe it or not, another 5% to get to 2,000 steps, 4,000 steps. This is why asset-based lending works. Even if everyone will tell you it's too good to be true, that can't be real, I looked it up on the internet and premium, you're going to find out, you know, I see Vans here, right? 831B, self-insurance, you know, from 1986 for farmers. That can't be real, that can't help me out. There's no way that, but you need to find the right people, and you need to do, and this is my last question, you need to trust and vet everybody. You need to trust and vet Jeremy, me, Van, Bruce Tolner. And when I say that, the biggest tragedy we have is we don't ask, but not just ask for help, not just ask for what we want. Praying is asking. But to me, the biggest ask is asking, trusting you enough to ask for the truth. I become really good at asking uncomfortable questions of people. That isn't a matter of you don't trust me. If someone says that to me, I'm saying, no, it's the opposite. I trust what you say so much, I'm actually going to take my time to make sure you didn't miscommunicate it or make a mistake on what you're saying, because I trust it. I want to make sure, because I know you have my best intention in this, but I'm going to double check. So I'm going to call the people that you referred me to. I'm going to ask you an uncomfortable question. I'm not just going to accept, oh, our revenues are up 300%. I'm actually going to see, well, you did $3 last year and $9. There must have been a miscommunication, because the way you implied it, I thought it was $3 million and you're up to $9 million in a year, not $3 up to $9. Because in the end, what happens is, if you don't trust people enough to vet them, then what happens is, because you're too afraid to ask an uncomfortable question or have an uncomfortable action, what's going to happen is you're going to lose, and you're going to resent that person, and you're going to blame that person for your inability to vet. You're going to blame them for something you already knew. And I know all of you have done this because I've done it to people. I sat there and knew the motherfuckers were lying to me, and I was too afraid to say you're lying to me because I was hopeful the deal would work out anyway. And when I found out they were lying at me, they stole my money, they cheated me, oversold me, back-end sold me, I blamed them. And I knew the whole time, so who's really accountable? That's right, me. So you help people trust and vet.
Yeah, trust and vet. I mean, you have to look, going back to your first question, is in this industry, look at the people that you're taking advice from, right? There's a lot of people giving out advice, right? Dave gives great advice, I'm giving some advice. A lot of people will offer it, right? But what separates them? What's their experience, right? Have they invested on their own, right? What's their track record look like there? Have they built businesses on their own? What's their track record look like there, right? Where's all that experience come from? Because ultimately, you want to derive your advice from someone that's covered as many bases as possible, right? That's going to save you the most amount of time and give you the best chance of deploying whatever strategy fits you.
Right, which is key, because if you don't know your timing and risk tolerance before you make any investment of your time, effort, emotion, or value, or your money, you're making a huge mistake.
It'll always be bad.
My wife makes fun of me. She goes, I don't know why anybody would take your advice on investing. You're a horrible investor. I said, no, I'm a risky investor. I know my timing and risk tolerance, and because I own so many assets and I run by old school principles of the income from my assets exceed my expenses, so I'll never go broke. I take huge risks on my investments. And I know up front that I'm taking a huge risk investing in this company or this deal. I know when I do that. So when it doesn't work out because it was a lottery ticket type of investment, I'm not anything but disappointed. Yes, I'm disappointed. The same way I would be if I bought a lottery ticket and lost my $2. I know it's a billion in one chance to win $500 million. I'm disappointed when I don't win, but I'm not resentful and guilty. And it doesn't stop me from investing the next time. So most people make the problem. And why someone like Jeremy is so important is not just because he can show you, teach you, take you through the steps, but most in trust and vet for you. But most importantly, it can help you decipher the hardest part of investing, which is knowing your timing and risk tolerance, so that you're only disappointed when it runs to its course of mathematical, statistical success or not. Not resentment and guilt, not blame, shame, and justification, not separation and inferiority. I'm an idiot. I lost over $100 million, blah, blah, blah. Now, I didn't know my timing and risk tolerance, but I knew I was taking big risk. Right, I knew that I had the ability to make more money. I knew that I was willing to roll the dice at that age. Not to the extent that I did, so I feel guilty and resentful. But I at least knew I was taking risks. So thank you, Jeremy, so much.
Thank you very much.
This is David Meltzer with Jeremy Wong here at the greatest stadium ever built, SoFi Stadium, $5.5 billion. Speaking of wealth management, Mr. Kroenke, thank you so much for allowing me to lease this space for 10 years with the biggest waiting room in the world behind me and the biggest guests with me. This is David Meltzer with Jeremy Wong with Entrepreneurs, The Playbook.